Okay, so this is really exciting for me. First of all, it's just exciting for me to get to teach. Thank you for allowing me to do so. But also, this is the first time I can think of that I have ever taught this book in any long-form content in any more than like one evening, necessarily. So this is a good stretch for me. But the other thing about this that you need to understand, and I'm hoping to set a couple just housekeeping rules here for you. I'm going to remind you of, I think, what has come to be called the Widen rule. If you have a comment in class that is more than three words long that I can repeat very quickly, then please wait for a microphone to come so that everyone can hear. I will probably be pretty strict about that, but I will invite, within reason, interruption in the class, because I am in one of the rare positions in this class that I don't have enough text to get me through, you know, 7 or 8 weeks. There are three chapters of this book, and so we're going to be lingering on the text. We're going to be spending a lot of time really delving into it. That's a stretch for me. That is an exercise that I'm going to have in preparing for the class to make sure we're having meaningful conversations and not just kind of like staring blankly at each other for the next few weeks. But I'm looking forward to that, and I hope that you're looking forward to that as well. So there's going to be a lot of opportunity for participation, a lot of opportunity for you to contribute to the class, and I would welcome that. I like that. I like going back and forth with the class a little bit. I don't mind if we go off the rails, if the conversation goes this way or that way. I feel pretty confident in the ability to bring it back to where we need to be. So if you've got contributions you want to make to the class, please do that. Also, because I have the microphone and I can say what I want in my own class, I get to talk about Jeremy for a little bit. If you haven't been here the last couple weeks, Jeremy has done an awesome job covering the first half of this book. And I think he even told all of us at the beginning of his tenure in the hot seat here that he doesn't necessarily feel like the most competent or confident public speaker. And I was just blown away by Jeremy and his ability to communicate ideas and to work us through the text and help us focus on what's really at the heart of the matter there. So if you talk to him, send him a message, or talk to him when he gets back from his trip, make sure you pay him a compliment. Just blown away by his humility and his thoughtfulness, and those are the kinds of things that I think you want in a Bible class teacher. A couple weeks ago, a number of us got to spend a whole week with a number of young, aspiring men who want to be, you know, stronger Christians and stronger Bible class teachers. You know, they're in high school and older, and so we spent some of that week talking about what it takes to be a good Bible class teacher. And so much of that effort, I think, comes not just from, you know, having good speaking skills and the, you know, the ability to wow people with big ideas, but just the ability to communicate ideas simply and effectively. And you know, what I can tell about Jeremy is that he put a ton of effort into his preparation. He was so ready for every thought, every idea, every question that came to him in that class. And so even if, you know, maybe he doesn't feel as proficient in this spot necessarily, you can tell that he really cares about what he's doing because he took the time to prepare for it. That's just awesome. That's a good Bible class student. That's a good Bible class teacher. That's the kind of person I want to listen to on a regular basis. So those classes are recorded. If you weren't here for any of them, you can go back and listen to them, and they're excellent. That being said, we're going to move into 2 Thessalonians, excuse me, I don't even remember what book I'm teaching here. And we're going to spend a little bit of time the next couple weeks going over these chapters, chapter 1, 2, and 3. But before we do that, I want to really kind of find out from you what's stuck around with you from the 1 Thessalonians class. Or, you know, if you weren't here for every single one of those classes, maybe just something that has resonated with you from the book, from your previous study. So I want to start this morning. This is one of those opportunities for you to contribute. All right, let's get those brains thinking. Let's get things flowing in the mind. Tell me what, maybe this works. Tell me what lingered with you from the study of 1 Thessalonians. And maybe if you have done that legwork in your own mind, how would you summarize some of the points in the letter? Now, don't cheat. If you've got last week's news and notes, don't look at Jeremy's breakdown. This is awesome. This is an excellent breakdown. I'm going to read part of it in a second. But just tell me, what kind of thoughts did you have as we were going through 1 Thessalonians? What kind of things did you think about? What, particularly as, you know, your mind wanders throughout the day and as you go on through the week, what kind of things did you find coming back up from our discussion in that class? Anything at all?
There's a flow to the book where Paul is describing first a life that is pleasing to God directing it towards an end where we will be with God. And it's this, it doesn't, if you break it up, it doesn't read like that. But if you read it all together, you get this sense of where Paul wants them to lead a certain type of life while waiting on God, and then the end is going to come at some unspecified time, but they'll be found pleasing to God because they continued in this path that Paul laid out for them. And so it's a description of a walk instead of a marathon, not a sprint, right?
Okay, so there's some lingering thoughts about, you know, what they're participating in at the time, the experiences they're having. I will say, that's pretty quiet. I didn't hear that super well. The microphone might turn that up a little bit. But yeah, there's a life that they are living that they're having to walk through, you know, navigating persecution and navigating the issues that they're having in the day. One of the things that to think about as we move into 2 Corinthians, or I'm going to keep saying that, 2 Thessalonians, is that I think there is, most scholars assume that there's not a huge gap of time between the writing of these two books. And so a lot of the same issues that they're dealing with that Paul is writing about in the first letter, he's sort of following up on, and he's addressing very much so in the second letter as well. I think maybe a matter of weeks or months maybe between the two letters. It's just long enough for him to get a report based on how they react to his first letter. So a lot of those same things are still going to be relevant as we move into the second letter. Good. What else? What other things lingered with people from the first class? There's a microphone coming down here.
One of the main things that sticks out in my mind is the multiple times and the continued references that we have to encourage each other as our spiritual family, and how important that is in this life, that God has left our spiritual family to help us on our journey here. That really impresses me.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason that Paul writes to them in the first place, right? He cares about them. He loves them very dearly, and he knows the things that are sort of weighing heavy on them, which is why he writes the letter in the first place. But he encourages them to look to one another in those times of need as well. Good. Over here, there's something.
1 Thessalonians is an example of what do you say to a good church? You know, here's a congregation that's walking well. And you see that kind of starting in chapter 4, where he's letting them know his concerns that how are they walking have been satisfied. And so then in chapter 4, it looks like he's kind of starting to say, do so more and more. So there's this call to growth, call to remaining pure, and call to growth as awaiting the day of the Lord.
Yeah, this may be why I keep defaulting over to Corinthians, because it's the complete opposite in that letter as to what he's saying here to the Thessalonians. Corinthians, there was a church, or the Corinth church, had a lot of trouble. They had a lot of problems. They had a lot of teaching they needed. And Thessalonians are being encouraged to just keep going. Do more, you know, of what you're already doing, and keep exceeding in the ways that you already are. That's an exciting thing, and it gives us a good pattern. I think we're going to talk about that a lot in chapter 1 next week, about what it means to be a faithful church. And Paul has a lot of opinions about that, what it means to be a good church, and how to grow in that effort and not just be, you know, stagnant or sort of pleased with what you've already achieved, which leads to, you know, not moving to something better. Good. Other thoughts? What lingered with you from the class? How would you summarize the book? Chandler, over here.
It's kind of already been said, but I think each week it was just reinforcing to me the depth of Paul's love for them, and how that kind of lingered with me throughout the weeks of, like, am I that invested in my brothers and sisters, in their growth, in their encouragement? And obviously he was an apostle, and that is a huge role in building God's church, but that doesn't remove, you know, that love that I should have for my brothers and sisters here, or even praying for people abroad. The amount of times he's talking about he's praying for them, and his expectations of them as well. I think it's just, it's just a really beautiful picture of he's expecting these things from them, and he's also complimenting them and encouraging them in it and reminding them what they already know about God. I thought that was a really interesting way that he encouraged them, was saying, like, you're doing this because you know this about God, and God has revealed this about himself to you. And so we talked a couple times, Jeremy did during the class, of like, these are actual phrases that we can use. You know, these are ideas that we can emulate and actually, you know, use his script essentially to encourage one another. But just how passionate he was about that. And for me, it's like, how passionate am I really about encouraging my brothers and sisters to keep on, you know, pressing on and to keep growing more and more?
Yeah, I keep thinking of it in terms of a relationship, like, if you've ever held any kind of teaching role, or I'm sure this is true if you're a parent, you know, with children that are getting up in age as well, if you ever have someone that you've poured a lot of effort and time and thought into, and then you see them sort of grow and succeed. I used to teach high school forensics a number of years ago, and so when I would see my students, you know, step on the stage and perform well, and then, you know, win competitions and things, that was always a really exciting thing, right? To see these young men and women who were putting all this effort and time that I'd been helping them with, seeing them succeed fills you with a very specific, like, type of joy, a very specific type of excitement. And I'm sure if you know, for parents, you watch your children grow and you watch them succeed and learn and things like that, it's probably that same kind of emotion, I assume. That's kind of what Paul's feeling here, right? He's seeing these young Christians, he's seeing them grow, he's seeing them succeed, especially in the midst of hardship, and he's filled with this very specific love about it. Like, here are these people that I've poured all this time, this teaching into, and they're doing well. And that's cool, I think, for Paul to see, and it gives us a portrait of what we want to be as well, how we should be, you know, considering our mentors, at least in some capacity, when it comes to the gospel teaching that's been given to us. I know I've had a life filled with excellent teachers, people who have really poured everything into me at this congregation and at others, and I, you know, frequently will bring them to mind as I'm living my Christian life. I want to do things that they've taught me, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because, you know, I want to honor them as well. And so there's all these emotions that are kind of wrapped up in that. Good. What other thoughts? Other ways you might summarize the book? Yes.
I think Paul was wishing in his heart that they had had more time between their obedience and persecution. Hmm. They were young Christians and barely getting into the word, and then he knew persecution was going to come. And he was worried that they wouldn't have the foundation laid enough through time for them to escape the things that were going to come in the right way.
I think that's part of his motivation for writing the letter, right? He starts addressing very specific questions they have about the afterlife and things like that, the state of their loved ones. He wants to make sure they know. He wants to make sure they have basics that are in place. Good. Yeah. Yes, one for Miss Casey up here in the front. They're coming for you.
I think I also like how Paul is reassured because the power of the gospel, because they had turned from idols to serve a living God.
Yeah.
And that it showed by their love for one another, how they were sounding forth the gospel to all the world. And even though he was only with them a short time, it wasn't Paul, it was the gospel that changed these people. And the same thing is true to us today. Because of that, Paul could write to them then about the gospel, about not to quench the spirit, to rejoice always, to pray, and that you don't need to worry, that you can endure persecution. Timothy had to come and reassure Paul. Paul needed reassurance. But what the Thessalonians showed Paul is they really had obeyed the gospel from the heart, and that the gospel has the power to do the same thing for us today. It can make us persevere and be more prayerful, and to have the praise and love of one another that we should.
That's excellent. You're thinking along the lines that I want you to for the rest of the class, because you're hitting some of the ideas that are going to serve as sort of my thesis for the second book. You've used some exact words that I picked, so this is awesome. Thank you for sharing that with me, just your understanding of the book. I wanted to do a brief just summary for my own sake. Here's how I was thinking about the letter as I worked through it. There were a couple things that came to mind for me, and I sort of tried to come up with a thesis for each chapter necessarily. That might be too small for you to read, but if not, I can give you a copy of the notes. So he does a couple things in each chapter, right? So 1 Thessalonians, we've acknowledged it was written to a young church, people who were young in the faith necessarily. And these Christians, they're accused of defying Roman rule because they were referring to Christ as the king, which would have been seen as treasonous to some Romans. But what he's saying here, first in chapter 1, he praises their growth in the Lord because of the stories he's heard about them, especially in the conduct of persecution. That's kind of what's focused on a lot there in chapter 1. In verses 8 through 10 of chapter 1, "For the word of the Lord has sounded forth from you, not only from Macedonia and Achaia, but in every place the news of your faith towards God has gone out, so that we have no need to say anything. For they themselves report about us as to the kind of reception we had with you, and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God." That's the one you pointed out there, Miss Mary. "And to wait for the Son, his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, that is Jesus, who rescues us from the wrath to come." So he's heard a good story about him, right? And so he already kind of knows their reputation. It precedes them, which is really, really exciting. Chapter 2 was all about how Paul references the hardship that he's experienced with his travel companions, compares it to their own circumstances, and then praises them for following his example. And he talks about how he wants to be with them as a result of that. He stresses, I think, that the role of Christian leaders isn't about consolidating power necessarily or material gain. It's about affectionate relationships and about self-service and sacrifice. So that's a thing that he really focuses on. Every time he brings up his own experience, he's not trying to do it to like show how great he is. He's trying to compare what they're going through to what he's gone through as well. Chapter 3, which is a little more information. It seems like he got some more information from Timothy there. And it seems like Timothy, he's returned to Paul, he's visited the Thessalonians, and he's brought a report of their strength, which is really good to hear. And he prays that they'll be able to continue in the face of whatever trouble they're experiencing now. Chapter 3, if you look at verses 11 through 13 there in chapter 1, or I'm sorry, chapter 3. "Now may our God and Father himself and our Lord Jesus direct our way to you. May the Lord cause you to increase and overflow in love for one another and for all people, just as we also do for you, so that he may establish your hearts blameless in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus with all of his saints." Again, he's hearing about the great things they're doing. He's hearing about the way they're enduring. He wants them to continue in those efforts. He wants them to keep succeeding, even though they've been doing a good job so far. So there's a praise, and there's a call to continued action here in 1 Thessalonians. And then, I think Aaron might have even made reference to this a little bit. The idea in chapter 4 is that Paul is urging them to continue in the teachings of God, and he's emphasizing specifically sexual purity in contrast to the culture around them. Right? They live in a very lascivious, very sensual culture where there are sex acts that are usually part of worship within the pagan temples. That's a thing that would have been commonplace, and he wants them to be different than that. He wants them to live differently. In verses 7 and 8 of chapter 4, "God has not called us for impurity but in sanctification. Therefore, the one who rejects this is not rejecting man, but the God who gives his Holy Spirit to you." So by engaging in the pagan worship rituals, they're rejecting God. They need to not be living in that same culture and thinking the same ways and using their bodies in those same ways. Verses 10 through 12 of chapter 4, "But we urge you, brothers and sisters, to excel even more. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands just as we instructed you, so that you will behave properly towards outsiders and not to be in any need." So this idea of the quiet life, the more I study the epistles, I see that phrase or that concept come up more and more. Christians are always encouraged to be pursuing the quiet life, the you know, unassuming, the gentle life, and that's an idea that I would like to solidify. I want to know, you know, what does that mean? Am I living that quiet life? Am I pursuing that quiet life? What does that mean? So the first verse that comes to mind just off the top of my head is later in Timothy, when Paul is writing to Timothy and he's saying, you know, pray for leaders and those in positions of power that you might live a quiet life, right? Be praying for those who are ruling over your society so that you won't be disturbed, right? That's a real concern for them in ways that I think maybe we have a hard time grasping with sometimes. You know, their just everyday life would have been upended by the persecution of the state, being accused of being an enemy of the state, a traitor to Caesar in some capacity, because you claim that Jesus is the king, would lead to a lot of turmoil and maybe a lot of fear, a lot of discomfort. You know, you can't just get up and go about your day if you are in threat of being snatched up and thrown in prison or executed in some way. And that's a thing that would have been a real threat for many, many Christians. So they're supposed to be pursuing that quiet life They're not called to be revolutionaries, obviously. They're not called to overthrow power structures in their pursuit of following Jesus as king. It's a very different image that is given to them. So I keep seeing that come out a lot. They want to be they need to be hardworking people that behave properly towards outsiders. And then lastly, in chapter 5, after answering these questions, kind of in chapter 4 about the afterlife the Thessalonians have, he tries to further argue that the return of Jesus as king should spur them to faithfulness, which is an idea that we're going to see carried into the second letter. This idea that the imminent return of Jesus should change your life today. This isn't just a piece of information that you know about the future and it's something you're looking forward to and you kind of occasionally bring it to mind. No, the fact that Jesus is going to return has huge implications for what your life looks like tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. I love that idea, this idea that, you know, I think often Christians can be accused of being aloof. At least I know this is an argument I've had with secular friends of mine, that, oh, well, you're thinking about the afterlife. You don't care about what's happening here at all. You don't care about, you know, the struggles that people have here in this life. This letter teaches us that accusation should never be true. No, in fact, the fact that Jesus is going to return should inform everything we do and everything we think about right now and the day after that and the day after that. Our lives should be completely changed by the return of Jesus, as opposed to just, you know, something we think about on a regular basis. I did want to read a brief summary. So Jeremy's done this excellent summary from the entire book in our news and notes last week. If you haven't read it, I wanted to give you just a brief snippet from what he said here. Kind of at the end of his article, he says, Paul ends the letter with a prayer that God would sanctify you completely and keep the Thessalonians blameless at the coming of Jesus. He reminds them, and by extension us, that God is faithful and he will bring his work to completion. Paul's message to the Thessalonians is filled with warmth, with challenge, with hope, and through praise, he celebrates their spiritual growth. Through prayer, he lifts them up before God. Through persecution, he encourages them to endure. And through participation, he calls them to be holy and sanctified in their living. And through the promise of perfection, he inspires them to live in light of Christ's return. I think that's a beautiful summary of the book. And he does a really awesome job by giving you those sort of five alliterations, the P items showing up over and over and over again. That's a great sermon for you to steal sometime if you ever need to write one down or you need a Bible class of some capacity. Just, you know, take Jeremy's wholesale here. I'll tell him that you did it. Every good sermon's stolen, so that's what you have to do sometimes. Thoughts about that? Other questions, other reflections about 1 Thessalonians before we hop into kind of what I anticipate will be our discussion for 2nd? Okay. Great. I'm probably going to spend the majority of each class front-loading my discussion questions because we do have so much time to talk about these things. I usually will throw them up at the end, and then we'll have, you know, 5 minutes to get to them, and by that time, everybody's kind of said everything they need to say. So that's probably what I'm going to do at the beginning of each class, to give you more questions. So let me do this. Here's some questions about 2 Thessalonians. What do you already know? And again, don't feel bound to these. If you've got another question that you're thinking about, something you want to contribute, you don't have to hold to these necessarily. But what do you already know about the second letter? Are there any themes that you see that are either new or, I mean, maybe you're just catching ones that are repeated in the 2 Thessalonian letter? And let me ask you this. What discussions are you hoping to have over the course of this particular book, this class? Anything that maybe you feel like didn't get addressed in the first letter that you want to spend more time on? Yes, over here.
I've been reading a book called Multipliers, and it talks about characteristics of effective leadership. One of the things that it discusses is the need for leaders to look at people and give them specific and direct praise for things that they're doing well as feedback on the things that they need to improve on. And Paul does both of those things in the 2 Thessalonian letter. He starts with this thanksgiving. He doesn't worry that he's going to give these people a big head for the praise that he's giving them. Instead, he targets specific things that they're doing well. He says, your faith flourishes more and more. We boast about you because of your perseverance and faith in the persecutions and afflictions you're enduring. He says, these are the things I have identified that you are doing really well. And so much so that I hold you up as an example to other people. So keep doing those things well. Here are some things where it's okay, but you could improve on these areas. And then he goes on to describe some other things. And so Paul is using these effective leadership characteristics to manage what they're doing well, to continue to encourage them to continue to do that more, and to help shore up some of their weaknesses.
Yeah, the ability to observe successes in your students, in your mentors, or people that you are, you know, pouring into necessarily is a really great skill to have, and one that we should adopt from Paul. I had a mentor a number of years ago. He's still around, but he's not here in Texas, named Nate. And Nate would do this perfectly. You know, he would come up to you, and out of the blue, he would say, man, I love how thoughtful you are. You were saying this thing the other day, and it just really stuck with me. And he will do that on a regular basis. He'll say, I love this about you. I think it's so good. And that always filled me with a lot of excitement. I said, man, like, Nate likes me. He likes talking to me. He, you know, he's listening to what I have to say. I really, really enjoyed that a lot. And I've tried to do that in you know, my teaching capacity as well. I've tried to find that natural ability to compliment people. I think it's a skill you have to develop sometimes. Maybe some people are better at it than others. I'm a pretty negative guy, and so it's easy for me to find problems with people and not necessarily the things that are, you know, successful about folks. So I've had to put a lot of effort into doing that. But Paul does that. He does that really well with this church, and it helps us too. You know, if we're seeing things in one another that are successful, we're seeing things that we can emulate in one another, I think that's the thing we should be pointing out. Man, I love just how encouraging you are. I love how thoughtful you are. I love, you know, just the way that you say things or the way that you talk, and we build each other up in these ways. That's a very small thing and an easy thing to do, but it's a habit that requires effort and requires development. Good. Yeah, I like that. What else? Claire.
Mine kind of goes with Aaron's, but I keep coming back to verse 3, and in the New King James Version it says, we thank God always for you as it is fitting. And I think about how the appropriate response, the most appropriate response when we see growth in other people, especially in times of tribulation and persecution, is thanksgiving to God. And it's not just because they've grown, but our growth in times of trial shows forth God's righteousness. And in verse 12 and verse 11 and 12, when we're filled with the good pleasure of his goodness and the work of faith with power, the name of our Lord Jesus Christ is glorified in us. And that's always cause for thanksgiving, and that's always fitting.
Yeah, rather than spurring us to jealousy, a measure of gratitude is a gift from the Lord, and a gift back to the Lord, you might say. The ability to give thanks to God for the successes that we are having or the successes we're seeing in our brothers and sisters, very, very exciting. It's been cool being here. I've now been here at Twin City 9 years, and that's not as long as some of you, but it is that's a chunk of time. And so I've seen this church change, and it's cool when our elders come to us and they say things like, take note that you're in the good times now. I don't think that's a thing I've ever heard at any other congregation. That's exciting. So being able to express to God some gratitude for the successes that we are having as a congregation and also take stock of the ways in which we can still grow is a good thing for us to do at this point. Good. What else? Anything else? Let's see. Okay, we're doing good on time. We may return to these if we have more time at the end, but feel free to just keep allowing the questions to percolate. We'll use the time as we have it. So in anticipation of what we're going to be covering, here's kind of what I've broken down the book into. Here's what we're going to cover week on week. And I reserve the right to change this if we need to. But I was trying to schedule out the entire class. Obviously, we're here beginning with our recap. We're talking about the book as a whole, getting generalized thoughts about it, and then we're going to drill down into different sections of text in the future weeks. So the discussions that I want to have. I want to talk a little bit about the intro here where Paul He paints a portrait of a church that he loves, he cares about, and he sees them as being faithful. And I'm probably going to pull in a lot of references to his other letters as we go into each of these conversations. That way we get a full... I'm almost going to have to treat the class like a topical class, just to fill the time. But I think that's a cool exercise for me, and hopefully it will be for you as well. But he's going to talk about... a faithful church, and we're going to see, you know, what are some other places where he praised other churches and how he praised them, and maybe how we can do that same thing. In the end there of chapter 1, in the second half, we're going to talk about the actions that Jesus takes on their behalf by rewarding them for the affliction that they are undergoing, and also the punishment that will be for those who reject Jesus. That is a promise that Paul talks about in some way. So he who brings affliction and relief. Chapter 2 is the funky one here, where there's a lot of references and there's some language that's a little esoteric and it's a little hard to divine what he's talking about. There's lots of opinions about what chapter 2 means. So I'm going to step into chapter 2 with a very open mind. I'll give you what I think it means. I'll try to help you interpret it to the best of my ability and hopefully give you enough tools to go read it and then really feel confident about it yourself. But I will say the idea of the man of lawlessness and the mystery of lawlessness that's referenced there, there's a lot of debate about it. There's a lot of... implications, because Paul is referring to conversations he had while he was present with them. You know, when he says things like, well, don't you remember we talked about this? Well, no, Paul, I don't remember what you talked about. I lived 2,000 years later. I have no idea what you meant. So we'll try to divine that to the best of our ability. And then this phrase here at the end of chapter 2 on the 10th, chosen through sanctification, just is a phrase there in the translation that hopped out to me. We'll spend time discussing that idea. As we get into chapter 3, he's going to strengthen and protect you from the evil one. We'll see the way, again, he provides relief to them in the midst of the persecution that they're experiencing. That's going to be a common theme throughout the 2 Thessalonian letter. And then, of course, the end of chapter 3 is where he gives instructions for people who are referred to as disorderly. There's a couple ways you can interpret that idea of disorderly. There's the concept of individuals who are living lazy lives. We talked a little bit about that in the first letter. I don't necessarily think it's just laziness. There'll be some application for us there in the way that we approach work, but it's a little more than that. There's the idea that you have an ordered life and a disordered life, and what those two things look like. Obviously, Christians are to be the kind of people who live ordered lives, and when we have people in our midst, because we often will, who live disorderly lives, how do we conduct ourselves towards them? That's a thing I think this congregation has some experience with, and unfortunately, it's something we will continue to have experience with. So that's a good conversation for us to have. Obviously, at the end of the class, you know, we don't have necessarily a full text to end that last class, but I want you to come prepared to teach me in some ways. That final Sunday morning, just be ready to discuss again what you got out of the book, what kind of things you found yourself thinking about as the class went on. You know, if you're a note taker, that'll be the morning where you get to shine. You'll be able to pull out your notes and the things that you considered. I'm not a supremely good note taker. I can do it, but I definitely struggle. It's easier for me to listen than it is for me to write. So if you are skilled in the note taking activity, then I will be looking to you that morning. That's what I want to do. That's the goal. I really want to drill down on those different ideas. And I'm open to, you know, different conversations. Again, interruptions. We don't have to follow my path necessarily. I did want to give you an overview of what I thought the book was like and just kind of nail down the biggest ideas, and so I've got three of them for you. So the thesis that I have for the second letter is this. I've already stated it, we've already referenced it a little bit, but I want the theme of the second letter in my class necessarily to be that the imminent return of Jesus should change your life today. The imminent return of Jesus should change your life today, and that's what we're going to be talking about in all of these different capacities. So just three things that I've got for the letter. So they're spending a lot of time talking about persecution. We've referenced that in the first letter. That's going to be here in the second letter as well. And Paul, he's really worried that their faith's going to waver, I think, in the face of the persecution they're experiencing. Again, these are young Christians. They're young in the faith, and they're under a whole lot of strain and duress from the very beginning here. And so naturally, when you face opposition, it is natural to want to avoid that opposition. And for the Christian life, that involves the sometimes ever-present thought that, well, I can just give up. You know, maybe all this Christian stuff, maybe living in a church and following Jesus and studying the Bible, and maybe that's just not worth it. Like, I'm just going to set that aside. That's a temptation, especially for young Christians. And I think it's a temptation for old Christians sometimes, too. When you get bogged down with sorrows and with the troubles of life, we don't even necessarily experience the level of state persecution that they were experiencing. And so, you know, if we are feeling it, who knows how much worse they were feeling it there. He's worried that they're going to waver. And so he's stressing that the suffering that they're participating in is one of the essential facets of being part of the kingdom. The inheritors of the kingdom in Christ's teaching are defined by their suffering. You might remember that in parts of Matthew 5 through 7, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount there. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall, you know, these things. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who are persecuted. The inheritors of the kingdom are always going to be the ones who are suffering in some capacity. He wants them to understand that. The kingdom was formalized by an act of suffering in Christ's torture and his death. So that's another inherent part of what the kingdom looks like. And in enduring the same suffering that Jesus did, we're going to be able to achieve victory over the enemies of God and glory amongst the saints when he returns. That's a beautiful, beautiful promise. In contrast with the fact that those who oppose Jesus are going to pay the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of God and from the glory of his power. If you don't want to have anything to do with God at the judgment, you're going to get your wish. You're going to get that eternal separation. And Paul sort of paints this as the ultimate tragedy. And that's not something that I want to experience by any measure. The second point here is the idea that there's specific information about the return of Jesus as the king. And so that's a thing that he already talked about a little bit in the first letter. He kind of referenced some of the ideas there in chapter 4. There's this idea that maybe some of them or some teacher in their orbit was saying things like, maybe Jesus has already come. And so they were feeling maybe kind of a little left out to dry necessarily. And Paul wants to help them avoid that. I think that's an important thing to think about. He doesn't want them to sort of labor under that anxiety. He wants the idea of Jesus' return to bring up hope in them rather than fear. And so he's trying to remind them of the things that he taught them back when he was with them. He is going to claim that some of the wickedness that is surrounding them, people who don't accept the love and truth of the gospel, it's not necessarily this idea that, you know, when we look to the return of Jesus, we're not trying to build frameworks of what the end time is going to look like. We're not trying to guess the day. We're not trying to, you know, figure out that whole deal. Instead, we're supposed to be changing our lives now and living almost as if Jesus is already here. That's the way we need to be living now. So that's part of, I think, the conversation we're going to have in that difficult chapter 2 section. We'll hit on some of those ideas. And then obviously these challenges for people who are idle. Don't live an idle or disorderly life until Jesus returns. Some of the Christians are being irresponsible. Some of them were refusing to work in some capacity, whether that's actual kingdom work or whether it's like work for money work. Some people think that the laziness was a big deal here. There's this expectation, well, if Jesus is going to come tomorrow, then why am I, you know, what am I doing now? Why am I even working? What am I spending my time on? There are people who will suggest that this laziness was not just, you know, sort of a thought pattern that they were into. Some people will suggest that this was a Roman practice where lesser fortunate individuals would engage in what was called patronage. There'd be, you know, some wealthy Roman citizens who would then hire people for menial tasks. And sometimes that would involve living and doing work for people in areas of life that would have been considered untoward for Christians. So if, you know, you're doing things at the behest of your employer because they just, you know, they want you to take care of their dirty work, that was maybe sometimes a way for Christians would get trapped into living disorderly or ungodly lives. Some people think that's what Paul is talking about here. That's an idea I'm going to study. I don't, you know, I'm not confident that it's one or the other necessarily, but that is one of the ideas that people have. But what he's trying to encourage them is to not live in this sort of freeloader mindset that's risen up among people and then, you know, have a disordered life. Instead, your life should be ordered and should be proactive in your pursuit of good things. And Paul, he's going to reference this as well. He's going to talk about his life. You know, I did a trade. I worked among you. I did these things. And I didn't, you know, need anything from anyone necessarily. We may talk about some economic conversations there and the way that the letter breaks those things down. That's an overview of the things that I want to point out in the letter necessarily. We'll get into those in greater elements and greater details as the weeks go on. So I want to end here with a couple more questions for you. I think these are some of the things that I was thinking about in the last 5 minutes. We've referenced that this is a group of young Christians, and we're fortunate here, I think, at Twin City. It might have been Jacob that said this at one point, but we, because we have a new sort of rotation of students every 4 years, Not that everyone over here on this side of the building is a brand new Christian necessarily, but when you compare the age of the Christians over here to the age of the Christians over in the other section of the building, there is a vast difference. And so when we've got young Christians, you guys, you come in, you ask new questions. How do we prepare for the basic questions that new disciples are going to ask? How can we best be prepared to address them? And then what kind of attitudes and emotions do we have that stop us from living the way Jesus wants to live? What kind of things get in our own way? What thoughts do we have that sort of stop us from moving the directions that we need to? What do you think about that? What are some of the responses, some of the thoughts you have? Or maybe if I didn't hit something up here, if you've got some other thought, other thing you want to share with us, then give us that as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple points for me. I love the fact that over and over again, the Bible kind of tells you that living a life in Christ is not a 100-yard dash. It's like a marathon, and you have to keep pushing yourself onward. I think of James 1:3, you know, always facing trials and the way we're supposed to look at that. The second thing for me is how I think sometimes as a Christian we get this ideal that life is going to be simple and easy. And when you follow Christ, that's can be totally the opposite of that. It can be difficult. And it's more about the way we look at life versus the trials and the tribulations that we're going through at that various moment. And so looking at this next book, it seems to carry that forward. And that's one thing I love about the Bible. It says the same thing over and over. It may say it in a different way. It may come from a different person, but the theme is always the same.
Yeah, there's a lot of clarification, a lot of same ideas here to the same church. And he's really just trying to make sure they understand the information he's given them. He doesn't want them to be confused in any way. That's a good Bible teacher, someone who doesn't want you to walk away not understanding what they've said. He does a good job of clarifying some of his more confusing points. And he's not, you know, shaming them for not understanding. He's not pointing out their deficiencies. He's just saying, okay, here, you need to know. And here's what it is. Good. What else? All the way over here.
I think we see Paul over and over in all the epistles, but especially to the Thessalonians, like you talked about earlier and like Miss Mary talked about, is that their living of the gospel by becoming imitators of Paul and of Christ, that's how we knew that they were chosen by God, right? And then that seems like a simple idea, like just be imitators of the gospel and you will fulfill everything that's been asked of you. But then in chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians, which Aaron said earlier, that this isn't something that you're going to perfect, but you need to keep doing more and more, right? So simple. How can we communicate the basics? By living it, and that knowing that that's not something that I'm going to do perfectly, but showing other people, this is something that I need to strive towards every day, even when I look like I know what I'm doing, right?
Yep. Yeah, imitating Paul the way he imitates Jesus, trying to live the life that he lived, is a big deal. There's a great joke on the internet where you talk about imitate God. Okay, it's a picture of like a lion from National Geographic. And then imitate Paul. It's a picture of like Simba from The Lion King. And then me imitating Paul, and it's a cat with a piece of bread on its head. Like, that's the way it feels sometimes, trying to imitate Paul and imitate Jesus. But we do our best. So, good. What else?
For the second question, I just think of some of the unique challenges that we face today in our culture that may or may not be different from times past, but I just think of like the self-sufficiency in not just the time that we live, but the place that we live and how that's really valued, to do things for yourself, to not depend on others, to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And so I just think that attitude is easy for me to creep in, just this idea of like I'm doing this work on my own. And again, like has been stated, it's their dependence on the gospel, it's their dependence on God changing them, that is what is
what God is expecting of them and what Paul is encouraging them to continue growing in is Jesus changing your life. And I just think that's an easy thing to slip back into as we are, quote, doing good works for God, still the attitude or the emotion behind it, kind of in a sense of, I'm doing this for myself. I'm the one who's, you know, doing these good things. And it's easy just to not rely fully on God in the way that he wants us to depend on him for everything every day.
Yeah, there's ways to slide to both ends of that spectrum. And it is funny how if we become proficient, then it can lead us to laziness in some ways. I don't know if that's necessarily a problem that they were having in their congregation. It seems a little more specific to me than that, but that is a problem that I think plagues us. And the teaching that we're going to find here is going to be really relevant when we discuss that conversation. Good. Others? Other thoughts?